This is a Miskatonic University special report.
Hello, this is Keeper Dan back again. I'm here with Keeper Chad and Keeper John, and we are going to have a second conversation with Mike Mason and Paul Fricker. These are the guys who have come up with the revised and 7th edition version of the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Welcome, guys.
Hi there.
Hi, yep.
Thanks for coming on today.
No, you're very welcome. It's great to chat with you guys.
Yeah, we're now at the 12 days to go mark on the Kickstarter, and it's a very healthy, successful campaign at this point. 255,000 of a 40,000 initial goal.
Yeah, it's going great. I mean, we're looking forward to getting onto the 270 for color and the 300 for the, the Peterson Field Guides.
Yeah.
So great if we can make those, but, we've got 12 days to go, so let's see.
Yeah, it is attainable. The full color is something people have been asking about since the beginning, so that way we can hold this up to be as a peer to the Spanish and French editions of the game. Those are both so just amazingly beautiful. And, I think the original version of the game, it deserves to be able to be on par with those. So yeah, let's get this thing up to full color.
Yeah, I think it just really allows Cozum a lot of options with full color in terms of the layout. Yeah, obviously the art, being full color more or less, and it just allows them to do a lot more with the, the layout and page design over the sort of, black and white and two color. So hopefully, it will be, as you say, on a par and with some of the, some of the more recent editions of the book, which have been fantastic.
Yeah, on the Kickstarter, looking at the 270 stretch goal for full color interiors, you guys have posted like a little teaser of what just a regular page of the book would look like, with some interesting like corner artwork and an interesting little underline under a like a label for that topic that the text is going to be covering, and just those types of real subtle full color details. That's the kind of quality and professionalism that I am so looking at. Not that the book isn't going to already have quality professionalism, but just, those touches remind me so much of the imagery that I see in the French and Spanish editions. I'm like, oh, I want that book so bad. I am pledged. I'm at the slobbering Shoggoth level.
So, cool, you get most of it at that level. So
yeah, there's a ton coming. I'm just like, wow, I can't believe it. So
regarding the color, I think we and Kozim are very keen to kind of be very restrained with the use of color. I think once you kind of go on board with color, there's maybe a temptation to use the whole rainbow on every page. Charlie at Kozim, he's very conscious of the kind of, to not overdo it and make it to look too crazy and busy and everything, be kind of very restrained with the color.
A lot of people have said that, they want color, but they don't want the text, unnecessarily obscured with a lot of busy stuff going on behind the text. So it makes it, difficult to read and that kind of thing. So that kind of restrained use of color and theme, I think is really, really key. So it not only looks, a fantastic book, but it's also eminently usable, so in the middle of a game, you want to be able to turn to a page and find what you want easily and be able to read it quickly and easily, and not spend 10 minutes trying to figure out, I can't quite make out that word or whatever, because there's an elder sign beneath it or something. So I think it's, very, important that it's, pretty, but usable as well.
Yeah. It'll be a tastefully done full color version of the book.
Going into color, does that mean that you will use different artwork than originally planned for a black and white or two color?
I think so. I think, there obviously Chaos's got a vast backlog of art, but obviously then some of it they may draw upon some cool pieces. However, they're very keen to put new art in this book. So not only looking at, you know, what art exists in, you know, with some of the licensees that might, you know, be nice to bring across, but also commissioning new art as well. So it's really, they have a wide canvas to draw upon, I guess, in that respect. So that will allow them the freedom to sort of really kind of put, you know, put a real kind of mark on the book in terms of the theme and how it all fits together. So there's a real, real consideration in terms of bringing, you know, some new art to it as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the Spanish book, we've got some beautiful, what they've done is about a dozen color plates in the Spanish book, which are like old movie posters for Lovecraft stories. And they are just wonderful. Obviously, the text at the moment is in Spanish, which actually I think is pretty cool anyway. But I think, you know, if we could get those translated into English, that'd be a lovely addition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple examples of those on the Kickstarter page, and they're beautiful art. I have no idea what they're saying, but they're really nicely done.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, if you look at some of these Spanish sample pages, there's a one I really like is a, there's almost like a full-sized hand at the bottom of the page, as if the hand, as if it's your hand looking at the book, and the text starts off normally but then starts to twirl and twist as if it's, you know, some mythos effect, or, you know, some sort of ancient tome. And that's used, I think, in a bit of a color text in the book rather than the rules bit. But in terms of just to kind of getting across the idea that, you know, words don't necessarily, you know, words aren't always friendly and books don't always appear as they should. You know, it's a great kind of way to convey that sometimes through the art. So, yeah, I think there's some nice touches in the Spanish book.
Now, one thing that was clearly laid out in a survey that you sent out earlier was that if we do reach the full color, this won't be an October 2013 release. That will delay the publication time because, well, that's a lot of extra work going into it.
I mean, there's obviously no, I mean, Charlie is obviously keen to get it as close to the original release date as possible. However, just the very fact of printing in full color changes the print time. It invariably lengthens the print time for the actual production of the book, let alone, as you say, Dan, about commissioning full color rather than, you know, line art, which obviously takes longer for, you know, an individual artist to actually put together. So there is, you know, it's very likely there will be a bit of a delay, but you know, we're hoping, you know, again, no promises, we're hoping that you know, before it goes to print, obviously the layout will be done, and effectively the PDF versions will be done. So we're hoping that people would be able to get the PDF versions, you know, near as possible to Halloween as possibly it could be.
Excellent.
That's good to hear. So the other stretch goals that we've already reached, there's no anticipated delay on that? Things like the, let's see, what was it that was being added into the actual book? There was the big art boost, evidence files. We got different maps, two color layout. Those things, we're not anticipating a delay from those?
Well, some of those things are integral to the actual rule book. So obviously the big art boost and some of the things are kind of would just go out in the main book. As far as the, like, the book of scenarios and the phobia decks and things like that, I'm not too sure.
Yeah. They'll have their own time frame.
Yeah, I imagine that, you know, they you know, Curzon will obviously be, you know, full steam with ensuring the rule book and the players book are, as you know, out as soon as they can be, which will, you know, probably mean that the you know, things like the phobia deck and the other bits and pieces that have been brought onto the Kickstarter will follow, but probably, you know, just a little bit later than the actual main rules themselves.
Yeah.
But we're still waiting for definite sort of time scales on those. But I know that work has started on a lot of those add-ons already. So, you know, it's just a case of them falling into the production schedule effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. As I don't know enough about the book binding printing industry to know if the sewn bindings that are going on all the hardcovers would be an issue or any of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to, in terms of, you know, different print houses, you know, do different things at different rates, and it's always hard to give a definite on those. But you know, rather to be safe than sorry, is to say that, you know, there is likely to be some form of delay on it. But Curzon was hoping that it wouldn't be anything, you know, it would only be a month or two, maybe three at the most, but you know, certainly, you know, in the early part of the new year, it should all be done and dusted.
Okay.
One of the new stretch bonuses and things that were added on are the new versions of the character sheets. Did the Kickstarter facilitate any change of plans? Because obviously, I think we all assumed, especially with some of the changes that are going on with how attributes are going to be labeled, or not labeled, but how you'll mark your values in attributes and stuff like that. There were going to be changes to the character sheet, but did the Kickstarter, because it seemed to me like it wasn't a stretch goal, you know, level by itself. It was almost like a bonus. Did the Kickstarter facilitate a change and say, hey, maybe we can do this too, and make a change to the character sheets? And have you all seen those or seen samples of those?
Yeah. The answer is yes on both counts, really. I think the Kickstarter has facilitated further development of the character sheets. So whereas obviously originally we were just talking, a standard, character sheet, effectively, a printed version and maybe a kind of a PDF, printable version. Dean has been working really hard, actually, on producing a really, really cool character sheet, actually. And he's really gone to town with it. It looks fantastic. And what he's been able to do is to add on a lot of functionality to the character sheet. So it actually does all the calculations for you. You just enter your base numbers and it just does all the work for you. Working out halves and fifths on different skills and allowing you to import an image for a character portrait and all those kind of things. And so there's a kind of like, he calls it kind of like the gold standard character sheet, which he's produced. And certainly he's sent us a recent draft of that, and that's looking great. But equally, he's also done a kind of a low technology version. So if, you've got a very simple character sheet that you can, input numbers into and print off. They're looking great.
That's cool. Because everybody is going to have, if you're sitting at the table, regardless if your scenario has excessive handouts or anything like that, everybody has your character sheet. Everyone's going to be looking at their character, and the design on that is something I'm really looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, this is Dean Engelhart, and he's designed some, he's the guy that hosted the State of the Tentacle interviews and so on his own website. And he's on his website, he's got some examples of character sheets that he's done in the past.
That's Cthulhu Reborn.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, those are the sheets I already use, so that's excellent to hear that he's the one doing the official sheet now, because his are just beautiful.
And he seems to have a good command of how to build aspects into the character sheet that take on some of the maths for you. You can put where we're using half and fifth values, you just put one value in and it calculates the rest, and you just print it out. Job done.
Fantastic.
And for those of us who do online gaming, it's really nice to have a character sheet that you just have the PDF open during play, and you can just change your stats as you go, and then you just save it at the end of the session.
Yeah.
I think that's just what you'll be able to do, which is really nice.
Yeah, definitely.
That's fantastic.
To what degree is the stat block changing for the character sheet?
It features the stat block for the characteristics, strength, and so on. That visually doesn't change that much. So if you're taking one of them, for example, you've got strength, where previously you just had one value and you'd have to calculate, if somebody said, well, we want to make a strength times 3 roll or a strength times 5 roll, something like that. Those numbers are already on the sheet now. So you've got your full strength value. And then in smaller boxes next to it, which are calculated on the PDF, you've got a half value and a fifth value. But the way Dean has done it really cleverly is that it looks visually very clear. He's made the half and fifth values in smaller boxes next to it. It sounds like there's going to be a lot of numbers on there, but the way Dean has done it, he's done a very good job of it.
Yeah, that sounds visually clean. That's nice.
Yeah. It's very kind of intuitive. That's the word. Yeah, you kind of you know what the numbers are when you see them. You know, once you see the box, how he's done it, it's self-evident how it works. So there's no confusion really when you look at the sheet. It looks, I mean, it looks pretty much like a standard Call of Cthulhu sheet. Call of Cthulhu character sheet. you know, you quickly sort of see, oh, well, everything is where you expect it to be. There's just a couple of little added boxes here and there that, that again, you know, once you see it filled in, you go, oh yeah, well, that, I understand that completely. Yeah, that works well.
On the writing and editing side, what for both of you is the item that you are most proud of in the edition?
Wow.
It's a good question.
And
do you want to go, Mike?
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I mean, obviously the whole thing is you know, quite proud of the whole thing. I think between Paul and I, you know, the how it's come out at the end, I think we're both very pleased with. But for me personally, the bit I enjoyed the most writing, there's two bits really. Probably the first one is a bit in the player's book. There's a chapter in the player's book called, Investigator Organizations, which basically is a range of different kind of, societies or bodies that your investigators could be members of. I've outlined a range of different organizations that go from your kind of Miskatonic society, you know, delving into the unexplained, to, you know, a group of New York cops, to a group of ex-World War I soldiers, to performers in a circus. There's a whole wide range of different groups that you know, hopefully will appeal to different people. I really enjoyed writing those. And I think the other thing I particularly enjoyed was the spells chapter, actually just going through the spells and really thinking about how they fit and what they do, and adding layers to some of the spells and things like that. That was a lot of fun.
Touching on the spells then, did you add any new ones? Because I had heard that y'all were trimming out spells that were, you know, maybe mentioned once in one scenario, and, you know, like call fish, that kind of thing, you know, getting rid of some of the fluff. But did you add anything new in?
We didn't really add in many new spells, totally new spells, because as you can appreciate, there was a lot of spells there already that did a really good range of things. And as you say, what we wanted it to be was, rather than a kind of a compendium of all the spells out there, what we wanted it to be was a core rulebook that had, you know, all the important spells and a good range of them that would be of use to keepers and players, ongoingly, rather than, you know, that spell's really only used once every 10 years, that they all had a role to play in the game. And kind of adding new material to them, what we've done is adding what we've called deeper magic. Because the premise was, well, you could read a spell in a book and potentially you can cast it even if you know nothing about the mythos, potentially. But an ancient wizard or somebody who's steeped in the mythos and who's also probably insane probably will read more from that, they'll be able to manipulate the magic more than a guy off the street. So what we wanted to do is to say that those guys can do more. They can do more with that spell. So we've added kind of layers to certain spells that we call deeper magic, that, you know, if it's an experienced spellcaster, they've actually been able to enhance or twist the spell further to make it do more effectively. So that was quite cool, adding in sort of layers to the spells. That's been a fun experience.
Yeah, that gave me a shiver.
Yeah, because some of them are obviously start off, you know, reasonably powerful, and then, you know, an experienced wizard then casting the spell turns them into really quite powerful. So yeah.
Well, there is a chance that the investigators, I mean, it depends on your game. I mean, often magic is something which is only very lightly touched upon by investigators, but there is a chance that an investigator might discover a deeper level to a spell. If it's a spell they've used a few times and they cast it again, it's a chance that they'll kind of unlock something else. Well, there's not like loads of levels, not like Dungeons and Dragons, but they might unlock the deeper magic within that spell, which, you know, isn't always a good thing.
Yeah, it could be unwittingly unlocked. And again, it adds another dimension to the story. You know, if the keeper wants to kind of add that dimension or send things in a slightly unexpected way, then it gives them, it gives them permission to do that as well. Yeah.
Can you give us an example of a spell with deeper magic? I knew
you'd say that. I'm just trying to think. Yeah. Paul, you talk about what you've enjoyed doing while I look at something.
Okay, you look up. You look up in your spellbook, Mike.
I will.
I think the one thing, if I had to pick one thing, it's probably the simplest one, and it's pushing the skill roll. I think that one. It's kind of almost the lightest touch that you can include in games in previous editions. If you're playing a previous edition, it's easy to bring it into the game. The fact that you can now push a skill roll and kind of up the tension. And the reason I like that as a keeper is that, I've had a player, investigator going to a hotel in Egypt and ask for more information about, you know, this archaeological dig. And there really wasn't anything that the hotel receptionist knew. But then they wanted to, and the player said, well, can I push the roll? And I was like, well, what are you doing to push the roll? And he's saying, well, I'm really going to, and he kind of narrates what he's doing and describes him sort of really putting pressure on the hotel receptionist and, you know, sliding some money across the desk and so on. And then he fails the persuade roll again. So he's pushed it and failed. So that allowed me, what it gives the keeper, I mean, you can always, if you're a keeper, you can always kind of bring the horror on. But if the player's pushing the roll and failing, then he's kind of giving you, really just handing you carte blanche to bring the horror. So I had the hotel receptionist, you know, maybe the hotel receptionist actually knows the cultists and he's in their employ. So he informed on them that the investigator was asking these questions. And that kind of opened up a can of worms.
Nice.
So that would be the one thing that I, you know, that I use the most.
Yeah, I have to say, after it just, I'm such a fan of that rule and have had fun since the playtest round that having been exposed, I sort of can't imagine being without it now.
Yeah, it was great. It's great.
Well, I found, as an example, I mean, I'm quickly looking to the Grimoire chapter, and as ever, you can see lots of them and think, well, what's a good example in it? Well, there's a spell you probably know called Death Spell, which is effectively the spellcaster succeeds in a opposed power roll, and after concentrating for a couple of rounds, basically the victim's skin forms blisters, and then they start to lose hit points every round until they're dead, really. So it's pretty instantaneous to some degree. But the deeper level of the spell would allow the spellcaster to, who wants a more cruel revenge, let's say, able to prolong the spell's effect over a course of days to enhance the victim's suffering. So it might be that, on the first day, the victim notices their skin's starting to blister a bit. And it's basically the same spell, but it's prolonged over a course of days. And the effects are kind of grow worse because you're having to endure them for longer. You're rather than thinking, oh, I'm dying, you're thinking, what's going on? And the worry and everything going on with that. So again, it's kind of allowing the keeper to kind of almost throw in some cool kind of story elements to that as well. Allows for investigators to be asking the usual question: what's going on with me? Why is this happening to me? And perhaps we've annoyed somebody or whatever. But that's just just one example. But a lot of spells have different do different things.
No, got it. Great.
Wow, that's And as a keeper, I'm already thinking of ideas on how to convey the achievement of a deeper level of a spell. I mean, because in my opinion, the use of these spells should be horrific, and so I would probably stain the player's that character's skin or something. Maybe they get a weird mark as occurring over their chest or. Their hand or something like that, some sort of stain that can't be, cleaned away, and it starts forming a glyph or something,
Yeah, absolutely. And if you tie them both together with what Paul's just said about pushing,
I was just going to say this.
Do you want to say, Paul? It's cool.
When you first cast a spell, so this isn't for, you know, your cultists and your monsters and so on. This is for your investigators. When they first learn a spell and cast it, there's a casting roll, to see if you can do it or not. So you've learned the spell and you're out in the graveyard or whatever, and you're going to summon your ghoul. And, you know, if you're crazy enough to want to do that, and you make a roll to see if you successfully cast it. Okay. Well, you fail. Well, I'm going to try again. I'm going to, you know, really focus on it and chant louder or something like that. Okay. Well, you can push the casting roll. And I had this happen. They failed it a second time, which then allows me to, you know, hit them with something else. So there's a list of suggestions of outcomes, consequences of failed casting rolls, and they kind of escalate from, you know, minor earth tremors, palpitations, to kind of blood coming out the walls, to, you know, ultimately, like, I don't know, your head exploding or something, you know, for like something, a god or something. So they failed the casting roll. I just had like the gravestone near to them just kind of shake and just explode and hit them with shards of stone. And then a few minutes later, as they were kind of giving the guy first aid, they're kind of looking around and they see this kind of whitish kind of shadowy figure moving slowly towards them. So the nice thing is you can have the spell work, but at a cost.
Yeah.
And that was a nice one.
Oh, that's great.
I do like that. It's awesome. I'm sorry. I was looking at the Kickstarter again, and I see the stretch goal of 300,000. Sandy Peterson's Field Guide to Cthulhu Monsters. It says it's reimagined. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Do y'all have plans for that?
It's still very much on the drawing board, but I think where Charlie is with it, he would like to kind of effectively. You know, keep obviously Sandy's text and a lot of the original illustrations in the book, but add to it, so enhance it, I might be getting mixed up here, but it might include a kind of like a note, you know, an investigator's notes at the side of certain encounters, you know, what happened when they saw this thing or what it did to them or whatever. So kind of adding additional kind of cool text to it on top of the original text and really kind of consolidating it all. But as I say, still fairly early days in that planning for that one.
Okay. The original one is such a rare document to find. It would be nice to have a more recent publication of it, changed or not.
Yeah, sure. And I know that Sandy... Charlie's been talking to Sandy about it, and Sandy's very keen for it to be available again. So I'm sure he's got he'll be feeding into that as well. So
good. It's got his name on the cover. He should have a piece of the production of it.
Sure.
Whatever he feels like contributing.
Well, he's also commented that Sandy is going to be writing a new introduction to the 7th edition.
Oh.
So he is.
Oh, that's awesome.
He is involved.
Excellent. That's good to hear.
Yeah, it was great to hear that, you know, his comment that he put on, I think maybe it was on his Cthulhu Wars Kickstarter or something. He said that he was very pleased with 7th edition and was writing a new introduction. So,
oh, excellent.
Which is nice. Because I think a lot of people, like, you know, we want to hear what Sandy's got to say about it.
Yeah.
So it's good that he's put that out, you know, in public.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, actually, I wanted to, since we have this opportunity, to put you perhaps a little bit in the hot seat and ask, we've seen a lot of supportive comments about the edition online and feedback on our forums and whatnot, but we've also seen a fair amount of negative feedback or people expressing deep concern and doubt about the project. So I wanted to ask you, how you respond to those are saying, why rework this system, a time-tested rule system, when it isn't broken?
How do we respond to them? I think one of the big things for me was when we did the playtesting last year, when we put it out to play test, we'd had some play testing done, and then we decided to go for the big extensive play test with like over 100 groups involved. That's 100 groups, not 100 people. And we put it out there, and there was a bit of trepidation, kind of thinking, well, what's the feedback going to be from all these people? Because there'd been a lot of discussion online, and you get, you know, quite a few people very concerned and working off of kind of, you know, what they've heard secondhand and so on. And, you know, whatever changes we've made, I was really reassured by the feedback we got from the playtest groups. We put out a poll, you know, online, and yeah, overwhelmingly people felt that the feel of the game was, very much like playing the previous editions. They felt that they liked the changes, and they kind of worked hand in hand with their experience. And that, you know, at the bottom line was it still felt like playing Call of Cthulhu. Why did we feel there were changes to be made? You know, over the years, I have kind of felt that there were some places that things could be, you know, altered and updated. It's a game that was written 30 years ago, and it's a marvelous game, but, you know, there's always room for, you know, some changes.
That's simple enough, yeah.
Yeah, I think I would, you know, echo Paul on that and saying, you know, Paul and I have been playing this game for probably near on 30 years, if not, you know, near enough the whole time it's been out. We've played with lots of different people, both because we've been very active on the convention circuit and running games for many, many people over many years. So we've encountered lots of different kind of play styles and how people have used the rules. And I think, you know, one of the things we've always noted is that, you know, people take a very, you know, standard set of rules and use them in quite different ways. Sometimes there's been some really cool ideas, you know, that we've picked up on, or we've had ourselves, or we just sort of felt, oh, it'd be kind of cool if you took this idea and went a bit further with it, it would really enhance rather than necessarily change the game. And so I think, you know, our kind of initial premise was to sort of say, well, it's a great game already. What can we do that would just make it as easy to play as possible? And are there any little aspects or, you know, aspects that will enhance the game further that provide both the players and keepers with more, basically, rather than taking anything away? It's been a case of what can we add that sort of builds on the great kind of experiences we've had and other people have had with the game over the years. I think, you know, as Paul said, there's always room for enhancement in most things. And, without changing the real base values of the game and how it feels to play and what the game is about. So I think that's, you know, where we were coming from. And as Paul said, the playtest seems to have, you know, borne that out. And, you know, certainly a lot of the playtest helped us to really, really think about certain things that we, you know, we changed or added, and really to think, you know, are they the best they could be? Do they do what they really were intended to do? And so, you know, we've tweaked and we've honed it down where needed, but some things like pushing have just stayed the same because it just seemed to work and people seem to love it.
And to those people that made, you know, that pointed out issues that they were concerned about or things they didn't like about the new edition, you know, not all those comments have made us change the book, but, you know, those, if you're one of those people, I'm speaking to the listeners, you know, your comment was considered. But we had people saying, rule A, that's fantastic. This makes my game so much better. This should definitely be in the game. You should take it further. And then we had other people saying, rule A, you know, about such and such, that's just crazy. You've totally gone too far. So there was absolutely no way, you know, some people were just diametrically opposed over certain things. And as the writers, we had to kind of, you know, consider people's comments, and sometimes, you know, from the playtest and the forum comments and from things you guys said, we heard you talking about on the podcast, you know, sometimes we'd go and change things and then sometimes we wouldn't.
Yeah. And also it allowed us to sort of say, well, you know, there's a real big proportion of people that really love that rule, but there is a significant, you know, number of people that really don't like that rule. you know, to not have the rule in means that, you know, 60-70% of people who really like it are going to miss it, you know, when they see the rules. And, but, you know, there's, you know, 30-40% of people that kind of don't really like it. So, well, what's the win-win here? Well, why don't we just leave the rule in, but have it as an optional rule? Then people that, you know, it isn't integral to the game. But for those groups that really want to use it, it's there, they can use it. And the groups that really have a problem with that or don't feel it's their style of play, well, it's an optional rule. They don't need to use it at all. It's not built into the core rules as such. It's an added extra. So, you know, so some of the contentious issues, like using luck, to, you know, suspend luck to alter roles, you know, we had a massive number of people saying that they really felt that really added and helped with their games. But there was a significant, you know, minority of people that really didn't like that at all. So, you know, we took that into account, and hence why, you know, when you get to that bit in the book, it's clearly stated it's an optional rule. You don't have to use it. It's really down to what does your group want to do with the game. It's you know, it's there for you to use if you want.
Does that mean then that someone who comes in with a kind of traditional sensibility about the game, who is resistant somewhat to the new changes, could actually pick up the 7th edition and play it absolutely as they always have? Or are there changes that are so integral that now they'll have to adjust a little bit?
I think, well, pushing is has stayed in the game as a core rule. But I mean, if, you know, anyone going through it, well, pick any role-playing book off the shelf. If there's a bit you don't like, most of the time people will just ignore that bit, won't they?
Sure.
But
push would be easy to exclude if you really didn't like it, too, right? I mean, just don't allow people to call for the push. Or is it integral in some other way? Can you say?
I think you could play it without.
Yeah.
It's not going to affect the rest of the gameplay. It's going to take out some of your options on in certain situations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know, like the casting spell roll, for example. If you say there's no pushing, it's really just an extension of in the previous games, the players would try and do something and they fail, and you're like, well, you know, they failed to break the door down. Well, does that mean it's like impenetrable that they can never get through it? So it's just kind of building in that.
Yeah.
So in the old system, yeah, after a while, you would have probably let them have another skill roll or do something. I don't know, but I think you can play it without. But
yeah, the general comment was whether someone coming into it from a I don't want any new rules perspective. Or only one or two. Is it so modular that you can add and subtract for the most part what you want of new stuff?
I think it would be difficult with combat to do that. I mean, obviously you can just, you can have the new edition sat on your desk and run the old edition. We're not going to come around and like burn your old editions.
Thank you. Wow. That is really...
That might be a stretch goal, actually.
I thought that was one of the early stretch goals.
I mean, some things are integral. If you're going to run 7th edition, some things are integral. And looking at combat, for example, combat is now based on opposed roles. And, you know, if you don't want the opposed roles, then you're going to be using 6th edition or 5th edition rules. So I guess, you know, you can plug and play different bits in, but it's not kind of designed that way.
I come from a little bit of a slightly different perspective as I've authored a few scenarios and I hope to author more scenarios in the future. Mm. And I'm aware of some authors who I'm not going to put on the spot, but who have expressed pretty negative comments about the future of 7th edition and have even said, well, if a certain project was going to be 7th edition compliant, then they were going to bow out of that project. And I don't know if that's, I mean, because really, I doubt that there's been any full version or nearly full version of the 7th edition rules that have been distributed on a limited basis, distributed to for folks to look at and review and to try and maybe craft scenarios with. And so I don't know. I would just give the advice that if you are an author and you're unsure about the 7th edition rules, get it, read it, and then see what is being displayed as core rules, what's being displayed as optional rules, and try and give it a shake, and try and craft a scenario in 7th edition. So
I mean, I think the big anxiety and the kind of the constant kind of drop back is that, oh my god, it's going to be like D&D 4th ed, and that's a good game. Each edition of D&D has been a good game, but 4th ed was kind of a paradigm shift in the kind of game that it was. So if you were playing 4th ed or you were playing older editions of Dungeons & Dragons, you were playing a very different game, not that it was better or worse, but it was, it's a very different experience. And that's what the reassurance I got from the playtests, that, while 7th edition is the most significant revision to date of the game, it still feels like playing the same game. So, that's what I'd say to the authors, that hopefully once they've read it, the scenarios they're designing, when it comes to designing scenarios, there's very little difference, really.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, perhaps some initial misgivings from some authors might have arisen from a very early draft of the rules that they may have seen. And, that was however long ago, but certainly the rules have been developed since then. And obviously through playtest and whatnot, we have kind of defined them down into what are the essential parts of the game that are, staying in, and what bits might now be optional, which is probably quite a different read to someone from that very early draft that had a lot of ideas and in it. So I think, like most things in life, have a read, make your own mind up, and but as I say, feel pretty confident that if you're writing a scenario, there's not a lot different that you're doing. You're still doing the same. You're still doing much of the same things, really. And that's the best I can say, really. That I hope they like it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. So, like I said, I'm already contributed, so I'm pledged at the $100 slobbering Shoggoth. So I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great.
Cool.
Thank you so much for joining us, guys. And we'll have another chat after the Kickstarter's finished so we can talk about the end result.
Sure. That'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be great. Always a pleasure to chat to you guys.
So exciting to have you on. Thanks so much.
No problem at all.
Thank you.
No, thanks again. Thanks again, guys.